I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're talking about episodes 5 and 6 of the new season of Undisclosed. It's about Jeff Titus, who was convicted of the 1990 murders of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett 12 years after the double homicide in 2002. Titus is currently incarcerated in Michigan and has always maintained his innocence. If you haven't listened to these episodes of Undisclosed, we're going to be talking about them. So go back and listen, and then come back and listen to this conversation. Joining me today is Susan Simpson, co-host of Undisclosed and lead investigator on the Undisclosed team for this case. Hey, Susan, how are you?
Hey, Rebecca. Doing good.
Also with us, Jacinda Davis and Kevin Fitzpatrick of Red Marble Media. Of course, that is the production company behind Killer in Question, which also looked at the Titus case. Hey, Jacinda.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
Good. Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Were you surprised by the question we got a couple weeks ago about whether or not you and I were married, Kevin?
I think surprise isn't the word, Rebecca. I think flattered is the word.
Aww.
Anyone would assume
Aww.
That I could be connected with someone of your stature. So I'm going to take it as a compliment. You may not take it the same way. I don't know.
No. It's fine. You seem great. So I'm cool with it. All right. So let's get started. I mean, I do want to talk a little bit about one thing before we get into it. Susan, I understand there's some big updates in the Dennis Perry case, right?
Well, I don't know if I'd call it a big update, but there is an update. As people who've listened to the season 3 may remember, Dennis is home now. He's been free for several months, and technically, he's waiting now to see if he's going to be retried or possibly have the decision appealed, because the prosecutor's office has, they're not quite convinced, I guess. Although, side note, recent election, Jackie Johnson, the DA, was voted out of office. So that could also bring changes ahead. But point being, the investigation from the GBI is ongoing. They're looking into Eric Sparr, whose mitochondrial DNA profile matched the one that was obtained from the glasses found at the church. So a few weeks ago, there was a new investigative step that was done, and they actually exhumed Harold Swain's body. The purpose of this was to take swabs of his hands in search of DNA evidence. Now, I guess the good news here is that the family of the victim had consented to this. This was not something they were, it wasn't just grave robbing. But when I saw this update, I was fairly alarmed, because it's a strange decision for them to make. And also, the odds of them obtaining actual forensic evidence from this are nil. I mean, I'd love to be wrong. I would love to think that this could somehow, confirm Dennis Perry's innocence and solve the case and all that. But no, really, it's just real gross. And I can't... No, I do understand why they're doing it, because they want to show, or at least give the appearance of having done everything they possibly could do to solve this case. But that's all it is. It's an appearance. Like, this is not something you do when you actually want to solve a case or you're actually thinking you're going to find evidence. It's just to make sure that you can't say you did everything you could to send Dennis Perry back to prison.
Isn't it? I mean, to me, it's kind of unusual for law enforcement to be taking this step. Every time I've heard about an exhumation in a case like this, it's very often either the family, like the victim's family, who feels like there are new answers that could be found, or some other like party usually is the one to sort of initiate the exhumation. Because my understanding, and I've, actually reported on a couple of cases where there were exhumations, including the Danny Paquette case, is that you're right. It usually leads to nil, right?
Yeah. I actually have seen a mix of cases where it's the prosecutor, or at least the police, that are seeking an exhumation. Although typically you're right, especially in cold cases or in old possible wrongful convictions, it's usually the defense is doing it. But if they're looking for evidence in terms of, like, say, an autopsy was never done, in cases like that, it makes sense. Like, if something, like, fell through the cracks and, like, they never even tested a body for any kind of, okay, there, fine. Maybe something's going to be there. But in this case, I have never heard of touch DNA, which is what this would be obtained from a victim's hands this many years on. And keep in mind, he was prepared for burial. He was, you know, like all
embalmed,
of that. Like,
probably, right?
Yes. What they should have done is get clippings right after this crime happened. That would be real good evidence. That you could still test. That has a decent chance of still holding up. This is just theater.
Yeah.
And really morbid theater at that.
Yeah. There's no chance that a coroner or an undertaker wouldn't have like completely washed the body. That's part of the embalming process. It reminds me, Susan, of I don't know if you heard about this, but I think it was about a year ago. Public pressure in the Maura Murray case in New Hampshire so exasperated the DA's office here, not the DA, the so exasperated the AG's office here that they decided to like go dig up this basement that like fans had been saying is where she must have been buried. They knew they weren't going to find anything, but they did it anyway because they just needed to say like, we did this.
I've not followed that case closely, but like, I mean,
because a public case, it's like they must be getting phone calls, letters. I mean, it was on your podcast. It's been featured elsewhere.
But was anyone calling for this? Like, yeah. Maybe they weren't. I missed it. But like, as far as I'm aware, there was no one out there in the universe who's like, you know what? Let's dig up Harold's body.
Right.
To me, I am very skeptical that they are seriously investigating Eric Spahr. And they're, and this is not talking, the GBI is, they are doing, I know they're talking to people, I hear reports back, they are out there doing stuff, but as far as the DA's office goes, it doesn't seem like they're interested in Eric Spahr. They're interested in either getting Dennis Perry back in prison or finding a way to be like, you know, absolved of any blame for him going home.
Right, right. I'm just curious, Jacinda, what do you think about this? This is like a case where somebody is pretty clearly not the perpetrator, but like the prosecutors just won't let go of the fact that he might be.
Yeah, you know, I'm not as familiar with this case, but it sounds like they're grasping at straws here. Like, I just don't understand what they're even looking for. Susan, are they hoping to find?
So Eric Spahr, what they have right now from him is his mitochondrial DNA profile and the glasses that were left in the church entryway. And that does match his profile, but it's also not unique to him. Everyone in his maternal line would also have it. But, you know, that's also not that many people, and no one else has ever been placed there at the scene in that maternal line, so there's that. What would be great to have, and I mean, what, you know, in the Gold Star case, with everything you want, you're going to have regular DNA that would uniquely match Eric Spahr and Eric Spahr alone. And since we know Harold Swain and his attacker grappled in the entryway, yes, it is very likely, possible, I'd say likely, that at one point the attacker's DNA was on his hands or under his nails. And that presumably is what they're trying to obtain now. It's just you cannot get it after you've had the body prepared for burial and buried for 35 years.
Right.
One of the things that I think that, from my point of view, that's always the greatest challenge in changing minds or in overturning a conviction or something is it's not just the evidence that makes that happen. You also have to have people's egos not get in the way, right? And if you're dealing with people who don't want to admit that they made a mistake, or if you're dealing with, you know, police department or attorney general or somebody who doesn't want to say we got it wrong, that can be as much of an obstacle as anything else. And I don't know enough about the case to say if that's happening.
Well, it's worse than that. In this case, their argument was actually not about whether he's innocent or not. It's that they got their conviction and he agreed to waive all rights to ever appeal or challenge conviction. So their argument at his hearing was literally, it doesn't matter what the evidence is, we got our agreement and we gave a valuable consideration to kill him.
Still want to get it right, you
right
know? Like, you should still want to make sure that the wrong person isn't sitting in jail, and you wonder what that comes down to, and that's you've got to be willing to put that away if something comes out.
Yeah, it's not actually a sentiment that they've ever expressed though.
Yeah, I mean, you ask somebody to trade, you know, the death penalty for that kind of agreement. I mean, talk about holding a gun to someone's head.
Right. I think one of the things that often gets underestimated is, I mean, I don't know if this is true for you, Susan, but it's certainly true in my experience. Prosecutors are some of the most competitive personalities I have ever encountered in like a professional situation. All the prosecutors I know, actually, they all do things like mountain biking and triathlons and like, you know, they're like real weekend warriors. Like they can't stop. They're just sort of relentless. I think it might be a personality trait. Someone who's sort of drawn to that job is somebody who's willing to like work really hard and get results, you know, for not as much pay as they would in private practice. It's like the principle of the thing. I'm super competitive. And I really think that plays into this. Like, a win is a win. Don't take that win away from me, right?
Yeah, and I'm not even sure it's that different from other attorneys, other practice areas, except that there seems to be this, a lot of prosecutors do seem to focus on the win. And like, to them, their job is to protect wins once they've been achieved. And there really isn't that expressed concern like, oh gosh, what if they're innocent? That's not the first thought that comes to mind for a lot of prosecutors. It's like, nope, we got a valid win here. We're going to protect it.
Well, there's also the concept that if somebody says that they got this one wrong, how many other ones is that going to open the door to, right? Mm-hmm. If you turn on one conviction and it gets overturned or you admit that you got the wrong person, it opens the door to how many other cases that people say, oh, they got this one wrong. Why shouldn't we look at this one? And suddenly you're spending years of your time justifying convictions that you already got.
Right.
Or hope to get in the future in this case. Hmm. It's worth noting that there is a upcoming trial. So Eric Spahr's first wife, the one who identified him as the killer of the Swains, she died, was murdered in her home under strange circumstances. Case went unsolved for several years. They finally, supposedly, got the guy who did it, and he's coming up for trial. But there are a lot of questions about how exactly they solved her murder. And guess what? Dale Bundy was the guy who made the arrest for this case, too. And apparently, I mean, we'll wait to see what happens at trial, but Eric Spahr supposedly was in the area at the time that she was killed, which is why this case is not just about the Swains and Dennis Perry, but also that upcoming trial.
I hope he has a good lawyer. Do you know if he does?
Me too. Oh, well, you know, I wish I could have talked to him, but I know that over at AJC, they want to talk to him too, but because of the pending trial, he can't.
Right.
But I know that they're aware of issues and that it's something to watch out for sure.
Okay. Well, keep us updated, all right, Susan? This is a really interesting case. I know a lot of people care a lot about it. I saw, you know, all the articles and all of the sort of developments here, and I've been following really closely. So keep us in the loop, okay?
Will do.
All right, let's move on to the Jeff Titus case. To start off, Jacinda, can you give us a summary of the cold case team's, in my opinion, insane theory of how Jeff committed this crime?
Sure. So the cold case team thinks that Jeff was, you know, they concede that he was hunting at the Shepherd's Farm 27 miles away from his property. At about 4 o'clock, he and Stan split up to go to their hunting spots. Soon after, Jeff becomes so consumed with the thought that somebody might be on his property, hunting on his property, getting too close to his property, that he picks up and leaves and drives home. Once he gets there, he finds Doug Estes on his land, who they theorize has tracked a deer onto Jeff's property. Jeff confronts him, somehow disarms him, walks him into the Fulton State game area at gunpoint, where he runs into Jim Bennett and has to shoot both of them. He then goes back onto his property, grabs the deer, throws it in his truck, and drives back to the Shepherd's Farm, where he meets Stan and says he, you know, shot the deer at the Shepherd's and says goodbye to the Shepherd's and then drives back home.
All right. There are a lot of problems with this theory. I will not get into what I think the problems are. I think that the word completely bananas sort of sums mine up. Susan, what is the first problem with this theory as you see it?
I mean, I guess, well, the very first problem with all of this is just the idea that Jeff would leave hunting right before dusk when the deer are most likely to be there. No,
good,
not going to
happen. Good point.
Which is, like, not proof of anything, but also to me, it's like, of course he wouldn't do that. Jeff is not going to leave when the deer are about to come out. But the whole, also worth noting too, that the cold case theory, isn't exactly what they argue at trial. At trial, they do seem to acknowledge this big problem with the deer and sort of sidestep what's happening there a little bit, because this deer thing is a problem because there were only 2 shots fired that afternoon. No one heard 3 shots. So it's very unclear how Doug Estes was going to shoot this deer on Titus's land or nearby when there was no shot that could have been the deer.
Right.
And there's a lot of innuendo at the trial. They're like, oh, look at this deer. He must have got it somehow. He must have like stolen it or, but the problem for them is that like if Jeff did shoot the steer, when do you have time for that? Like he has like the tiniest of margins to thread here, and to also have killed a deer doing all that. I mean, Jeff's a good hunter, but not that good.
Right.
And then we mentioned on episode 5, this issue about the deer being ungutted, which for the prosecutor, for the cold case team, is more proof that Jeff was a murderer because he somehow didn't do things the right way, and him not gutting the deer means something's off. Well, after that episode, I've heard from hunters all over the U.S., and apparently a lot of y'all ain't gutting your deer.
Yeah, not in the woods. I never see that here. I always see people throwing a whole deer in the back of their truck. I mean, my take on this is really simple, is that like he wants to do it with his buddy. Like they're going to bring it home. They're going to do it. That's like part of the activity, right? After dark, that's when you go home and you take care of that. But yeah, that's, I'll tell you, I see it all the time. I walk in the woods, the people hunting deer all the time. I saw a guy just like a couple weeks ago with dragging over his shoulders and sort of half dragging this like big deer and just like lobbing it into the back of his truck.
See, I mean, the
thing though is that Jeff, yes, not every hunter guts their deer in the field, but Jeff normally did. Mm. It was out of character for him not to field dress. So that's what they're focusing on. Not really whether or not one does that, but that Jeff normally would have done that.
And to him, he's like, yes, I usually would have, but it was cold and dark and I wanted the guts. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a question, though. Is this do you know if there was like a limit, like a shooting limit on how many deer you can bag in a given season?
There is. I should probably get more into that in the show. Jeff was kind of, he was the benefit of block permits, which is he could shoot all he wanted, basically.
Right.
He could do what he wanted. So he had no limits, but it was the first year of the season. And his rationale for not gutting it is like, one, like it was just late and cold. Like, let's do this somewhere warmer, like my barn. And two, he hadn't gotten the deer yet. So he hadn't been able to do the very legal method of just happening to gut a deer nearby where you trap, which just happens to bring, you know, foxes closer in.
Right.
So
right.
This was kind of killing a lot of birds with one stone to him.
Yeah. Kevin, what do you think of this theory of the case?
Well, the thing that always resonates in my mind is when we talk to one of the original detectives, Bruce Worsema, and he lays out the timeline, and he says something that stands with me sort of to this day, where he says, it's possible, but not probable, right? You look at the timeline, and I keep saying to myself, and I think I said this to Jacinda when we were sort of first doing the interviews a year ago, is, yeah, I mean, technically you can make the argument that this crime was committed this way. Like the timeline works in the theory that mathematically it can work. They wouldn't have presented it if mathematically it couldn't work, right? But everything has to go completely perfect, and he has to, you know, change what he traditionally does about like field dressing deer, and like, so you can make the argument, but I can make a seemingly logical argument for everything. It doesn't mean that that's what happened. I mean, so many things with there's no margin for error, and you have to believe everything that they say as sort of breaking from tradition still happening. And that's what becomes so difficult. So Worsema will say, yeah, it's possible, but not probable. Right. And I don't know exactly what he's thinking. And it seems very unlikely. You know, it's like winning the lottery type unlikely.
Right.
And also implausible in terms of the actions people take. Like, it just doesn't make sense from like a logistical point of view. It's not just lucky that it happened this way. It's like a lot of weird things happened in a certain sequence that just happened to possibly thread this needle.
Right. And the idea that he would shoot a deer as a cover-up is insane because it is impossible to shoot a deer on command. Like, that is not a thing that happens.
Right. And then I think it was, you know, the suggestion in the podcast, I forget who said it, that his mind is just working a mile a minute at that point, and he's almost manic, and he throws it in the truck, and like if somebody else shot it, if Esther shot it, it's just all, I mean, it starts to move into one of those action movie scenes from a Hollywood movie where you're like, okay, well, I guess they could have outrun that falling building, but that seems unlikely. But right. I mean, it's possible, I guess.
Right.
You know, I really wish that the cold case team had let me use their interviews for the podcast because, well, one, I think it would help to give a more fleshed out view of what they actually think. Just because there's less time, there's less stuff y'all couldn't include. But there's nothing more here. There's not some like explanation that's not being shown that would make this theory make sense. Right. There's nothing that they have said that like somehow makes more sense than what you're hearing. There just isn't.
It was the one thing that bugged me when I first started researching this case, and it still bugs me, you know, that no one can, the idea that Jeff, everyone knows Jeff loves to hunt. He lives to hunt. And the idea that he would just pick up, you know, shortly after 4 o'clock, like Susan said, but just when it's becoming prime time to find a deer, that he would pick up and leave. That's never made sense to me. And no one has ever been able to offer an explanation that does make sense. Him being territorial, him wanting to check his traps, him thinking somebody might be on his property, that just doesn't ring true to me as reason enough to get Jeff out of his hunting spot to go check out his property. And the only thing, I forget who, I think Susan, we were talking to Big Jack. The only thing that I remember this moment where it hit me like, well, maybe that's why, is that he went to his hunting spot. He shot a deer very quickly and thought, okay, I got a deer. I don't need another one. Stan still has a couple hours left, so I'll go back and check my property.
See, the problem is, though, Jeff would never have the thought, I don't need another one.
Right. That's what I was thinking, is that maybe that's why he threw it. I mean, one of the things I was thinking was wondering was like, if he could shoot more than one, maybe he got one right away, threw it in his truck and went back out, right? He didn't want to waste the time.
If he went back to check his traps after he had shot the deer and he had thrown the deer in his truck, I don't think Jeff would have then hauled it all the way back to the Shepherd's farm again. Right. He probably would have dumped it out at his house when he got there.
Right.
There was also this big buck. So when Jeff tells a story about like, and Stan's letter is right. Like when Jeff is talking, he's not giving a defense. He's telling a hunting story. And he describes how he hunted that day and where he went. And like, there are lots of things Jeff does not remember that day. Like his memory is not perfect, but he can tell you about, like, I swear, probably half the deer he's killed, he can tell you exactly how it went down. But that day he describes this buck that he'd seen a couple times and had, well, he tried to shoot once and didn't, got the doe instead. And that he'd seen another time, but too far away. And like, this buck is what he wants. Like, even if he got the doe, that buck that he keeps seeing is what he's focused on and never gets in the end.
Right.
Like, he's not going to leave just because he got the doe and the you know, impressive buck is still out there.
Right. He's like Philip on the Crown. He needs to take Diana out there and get that buck. All right, I do want to talk about Stan Driscoll, who you just mentioned. Really fascinating character. Susan and you and I had a little texting about him as I was producing your episode. We'll talk about that in a sec. But we learned that Stan died shortly after filming his interview for the Killer in Question episode on Jeff's case. That was really some moment there in the podcast. Jacinda, what was Stan like in your interactions with him?
Stan was, let me give you an example of Stan. He called me one day and we were talking and he said to me, Jacinda, I just want to tell you that you guys did a really great job researching and investigating this case. It's very thorough and it was just a really great job. And I said, oh, thank you, Stan. And he said, well, thank you is not an appropriate response because it wasn't meant as a compliment. I was stating a fact.
All right, I'll tell you what I said about Stan. I wrote to Susan and I said, I'm getting some real like James Comey vibes off of Stan, where everything is just like, I have to do this because of this reason, and just like so singularly focused on that, you know, that sort of artifice of pride and process and like almost that Ernest Hemingway, like, you know, this is the code that I have to follow kind of situation. You know, there's sort of like a narcissistic element to that to me. But I hear, Kevin, you have your own theory about Stan's background.
Oh, yes. I was wondering if Susan was going to set me up with this one, but here's the thing. Like, first I'll say before I get into what I think Stan's background is, that he's one of the most maddening people I've ever interviewed in my life. Right. Like I think part of it is deliberate. He wants people to acknowledge that they're not as logical and whatever as they should be. So if you look at in the podcast, like the way in which he's like responding to the prosecutor's questions on the stand, like could have been several hours. Well, how many hours? He's almost just being a jerk, right?
Well, not almost.
And he puts people off. And so when we showed up to film, suddenly there became this scenario, and I'd never spoken to him before that. That became the scenario where he wasn't sure whether he was going to do it. And I was like, "Well, wait a second.
Oh, I didn't know that."
We came all the way to Michigan, and no, actually, we're going to do it. And so I'm talking to him, and suddenly I had to prove myself to him. And he's like, "No one's represented Jeff's story well," And it became this thing where I was auditioning for him. And so I just started acting towards him like he was acting towards us.
Mm.
And suddenly sort of being a jerk to him sort of worked to a certain degree.
Wow.
And I was like,
that's
I'm
his
actually
love
really
language.
Good at this. Yeah, right, right. I go, I'm actually really good at this. And I'm trying to tell this story so that it comes through with your point of view. Yeah. And if you allow us to do that, your point of view is going to come through. If you don't, then you're going to be missing from the show. But it was this thing where I just started acting hurt to him as well. And he really responded to that. And it was just maddening. One of the producers said, Kevin's just like him. But it still makes you laugh. But it was sort of this intentional thing to try and get him to engage with me so that we could conduct the show.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, my theory on his background is that there's just something very odd there. Like, he has this weird process of how he looks at information, and he's very unemotional. If you look at where he's traveled, and I can't remember all the places, they're all like hotspots in like Africa and Asia where governments were overthrown. I always had this theory that he sort of somehow worked for the CIA or some sort of front group.
Yep.
And he would sort of pepper some of that stuff in there when we were like at lunch or we went to the Shepherd Farm and he and I were, I guess you call it chatting, while they're sort of setting up the camera and whatever. And he just says the oddest things, like with these open-ended things, like, yes, I was in, you know, I was in that part of the world at
Rhodesia.
This particular time. And he'll Rhodesia, right. And he'll make reference to something happening to the government there. And then he'll just stop talking, you know, like it was all so bizarre. And maybe I filled in the gaps in my own mind because that's a great story. But he's such an unusual character. It all seemed plausible to me that he could be involved in all of that stuff.
I believe it.
And I don't I don't think that it upset him that I was, you know, potentially thinking that. I think his goal was to have me think that.
Right.
And whether it's true or not, I don't know. And for all of the sort of distance he wants to put him between himself and he doesn't care what others think, I do think he cares what others think. I think he wants people to believe he's a mystery and to acknowledge that he's smarter.
Right, right.
So,
So as I learned in the podcast, Wind of Change, you're either allowed to say you were in the CIA or you're not. So it sounds like he's not, but he really wants to be, right?
Well, when Kevin first shared this theory, I was like, no way. But then, yeah, no, the more I looked into it, I'm like, okay, well, that's definitely the least weird explanation.
Yeah.
There's something weird in his background. I mean, he's either crafting this life for himself so that people sort of think that, or he actually had it and he's being truthful and he can't really talk about it. But either way, he was one of the most maddening people we've ever encountered. And for hours working with him that day, he would just simply answer questions in a way that was almost not human.
Right.
And I think he did it to some degree to get a rise out of us. Wouldn't you say, Jacinda?
Yeah. I mean, it was definitely frustrating. I did think there were moments where he kind of let his guard down and he opened up. And you hear in the podcast, in the last episode, he even broke down at one moment and became emotional. Yeah. So I don't know if it's because it was just a really long day or what brought that on, but yeah, it was really frustrating. There's something that didn't feel authentic about a lot of his answers, but yet they seemed as authentic as maybe he could muster. It was hard. It was definitely.
I do think that without question, that if Jeff's alibi witness was anyone on this podcast right now, or virtually 90% of the people you can name in your life, he may not be in jail. I think Stan was so off-putting and peculiar and so open to any theory that could be presented to him that could work mathematically, that I do think that that probably fueled the cold case team for a bit. I think that when he probably said, yeah, I'll call him and see what I can record the phone call. I mean, is Stan being open to that possibility, I think, fueled the investigation, in my opinion.
Susan, do you agree? Is Stan to blame?
Well, indirectly, yes, but that's for later. I do think it's worth pointing out that Madison was the first person to interview Stan Driscoll, and he did not walk away thinking Jeff was guilty. He walked away going, oh, this all makes sense. It wasn't until some of the cold case teams, wasn't until like Mike Brown got involved, and then he's like questioning him, that they suddenly make something out of Stan Driscoll. The first cop who talks to Stan Driscoll doesn't walk away saying, oh, this is weird. He's like, oh, yeah, okay, we're good to go here. I think that Stan also, despite the fact he's not an ideal witness, he could have been useful. He was useful. He could have been an effective witness if there's a defense attorney worth a damn who was, you know.
No, you're right. I've never seen the transcript of those interviews. I'm not sure that they exist. But if they do, I'd be curious as to, is he following up saying, yeah, I didn't see him for 2 hours during the day, but that's not uncommon. Like, he said it in our interview.
Yeah, he does say that. Yeah, he does say it's not weird. He doesn't make it sound weird at all. The thing that Stan always got, that made Stan first out, was the Big Jack story. That's what he didn't like. And that was where Jeff said, yeah, Big Jack Warren told me that a guy from Athens took the gun, but brought it back when he found out it was a murder.
But also, just in Stan's defense, no one interviewed him for 10 years. And if the original detectives had interviewed Stan, you know, a few days after the crime, he would have had a better memory of what happened. He might have remembered hearing a shot fired, you know, Jeff shooting the deer. He might have remembered if the deer was in the truck or not in the truck. He might have remembered, you know. So that was a huge mistake, I think.
Yeah. Now, you talk about it in the podcast, and we mentioned it in our show with a bite from him too. Like, there was nothing unusual about the day until they get back to the Titus farm and they find these bodies. So you don't have all of those other memories of the events, because it happens at the end of the day, not at the beginning of the day.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, Jacinda, what do you make of Stan and Jeff's friendship? It seems very unconventional. I know that if I hate somebody that my husband likes, like, my husband just stops being friends with that person because I'm such a pain in the ass about it. But it is weird. I found Stan, especially in his letters, like, for someone who, I mean, maybe Jeff just doesn't care. I mean, I don't want to use this loosely, because it's ableist and it's not fair. But I just kept wondering over and over again if both of these people were, like, a little bit on the spectrum in terms of, like, friendship for them is defined very differently than friendship is for somebody who has an ability to sort of see what's really kind of going on an emotional level. You know what I mean? And I was just thinking, like, Stan's letters to Jeff in prison are so condescending. And I know he thinks he's being helpful, right? So I'm just curious about, like, does Jeff know that Stan thought he was being helpful and a good guy? Or it's just a weird friendship. What do you make of it, Jacinda?
It is a weird friendship. Maybe it's a bit of a bromance. I don't know. They don't seem like a likely pair, right? But they are a lot alike in many ways. People describe Jeff as being socially awkward and not picking up on cues. Like, you know, like you said, maybe they are both on the spectrum a little bit. But somehow they got along and they liked each other. And I think they appreciated each other's love for hunting. Stan was a hunter. He hunted in Africa, you know, and he didn't have as much experience deer hunting, and he relied on Jeff. So they were able to provide something to each other. And maybe it's because they didn't bother each other. Maybe they were the perfect friend for each other. You know, they're not calling each other. They're not asking for favors. They're not getting emotionally involved in each other's lives or wives' lives, you know. So in some ways, maybe they were the perfect match for each other because they were able to find a friendship without being the kind of, you know, friends that maybe we think of when we say the word friend.
Right, right.
But they enjoyed each other's company. Like, it was a real friendship in that sense. They, like, for whatever reason, they just like being around one another.
Yeah.
And I think the two of them, I think Jeff is actually the more self-aware one.
Yeah.
Which would have killed Stan to hear someone say that about them. But you read the letters, and, like, Stan writes about, like, hunting trips after Jeff's in prison. And, like what struck me about them is this sense that he's come to the realization. He's like, I hunted, but doing it alone wasn't actually as fun or rewarding as usual. That's strange.
Right.
As if, like, he had never before considered that, like, it was Jeff's presence that he also liked about it.
Right, right. I want to talk about the timeline. Susan, would it have been possible for Jeff Titus to return to Fulton and then drive back to the Shepherd Farm again?
Like, I'm kind of with Wersima on this one. Like, possible, not probable, but that's only if you like, it depends on how you define a lot, because there's so much undefined here and there's so much left unsaid that meaning almost has no meaning, because like, how can you like argue like, there's nothing concrete to hold on to. There's nothing there to actually like establish the timeline or establish facts and say this will or will not work. You're just like up in the air saying, could someone drive back 27 miles back again? Well, yeah, mathematically a car will go that fast. But all the other stuff in between, it doesn't add up so well. And I think the important part is once you add Bonnie's story to it, no, you can't do it anymore. Hmm. That's when this whole timeline breaks down. And she is their only evidence that this whole thing even happened.
Right, right. Talk a little bit about that. Just remind the listeners why that's true.
So Bonnie is a witness, the neighbor's daughter, adult daughter. She had some kids that her mother, the children's grandmother, would watch while she was out hunting on their property. And she is the witness who places Jeff Titus in the Fulton area at her mother's house at, well, she says about a little after 5:15, so, you know, 5:30-ish thereabouts at trial. Of course, this is not what she said in 1990, when, according to Orsema, she said he was there 8 or 9, or even what she said in 2002, about 2 months before trial, when she says 6:15, 6:30. And although her statement changed in that 2002 interview, it didn't change enough to actually fit what the prosecutors wanted it to.
Right, right.
And then, voila, we get to trial, and she says this whole 5:15, I stopped hunting thing.
Right.
Which would put Jeff in the area about the right time to murder. The problem is this whole drive, this whole trip from Battle Creek and back again, no longer works once you add in her, like her data point to the story.
Right, right. Kind of like the timeline that the state made Jay say about Adnan Syed's case. It's like if you say one thing, the other thing can't be true.
Yep.
But they're not trying to compare those two things at all, which is fascinating to me when that happens. Question about the Shepherds. Jacinda, would they have been able to testify, you think, if Titus's attorneys had wanted them to?
You know, it's hard to say. I think it's hard to say. I don't know. I don't think Mr. Shepherd would have been able to, but maybe his wife. And Susan knows better than me, of course, whether or not there would have been a way to present their original statement without them actually being the ones there to testify.
Right.
That to me is the question.
Right.
Well, what's frustrating in that video that Larry Crandall and Stan Driscoll made is they keep only talking to Gerald Shepherd. And to be fair, Gerald was more involved with this. Like, he's the one who had more interactions with Jeff. He and a friend both talked to Jeff when they were there. And there was a deer that he'd shot that Jeff helped him clean. So there was more stuff that could, like, and another witness that was never found, Smitty, that could have confirmed Titus was at the farm that day. But Eloise was there, too. She was in the house. She talked to him. And, like, she seems way more lucid. You can actually hear her in the clip I played in the show where they try. Yeah.
You can hear her chiming in with the answer.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating that they don't. Yeah, it's frustrating they don't ask her what she remembers.
Susan, if the defense attorney had called the detectives, the original detectives, they would have been able to relay the statement, right? It wouldn't have been hearsay then, right?
Yeah. Well, it's still hearsay, but she can get it in. So the couple routes they could have used, if they were capable of answering basic questions, they could have had them go on the stand and get in the document as sort of like Michigan, unlike the federal rules, has a catch-all exception that would allow you to get in the statement when the witness does not recall it. The more likely route would have been to do a recorded recollection under Michigan Rule of Evidence 8035. And that is a recorded recollection. It's a document that pertains to matters that the declarant, whoever wrote the document, once had knowledge. The declarant now does not remember or does not have sufficient recollection as to that matter. And also the document was made by the declarant, or if not by the declarant, to have been examined by someone, by the declarant, and shown accuracy reflecting the declarant's knowledge when that was refreshed. Long story short, they could have used the detectives, they could have used Worsema and Ballot to get in the one-page written statement from the Shepherds. Now, what's interesting is that the Shepherds actually had a written statement. That's not something that the detectives did a lot. Actually, I'm not even sure they did it. This is probably the one time they had an alibi witness that they got a statement from, which uniquely would have made Jeff Titus one of the few witnesses of the case who could have gotten the alibi in anyway, even if the alibi witness was no longer around. And the mystery to me, and I still have no answers here, so I can't even speculate, is why they didn't try that, why they didn't call the detectives, why they didn't try and get the Shepherd statement in at all. And they just, I mean, Kevin, just ended y'all have a sense of this other than they just didn't?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge mystery to me as well. Like, why didn't Jeff's attorney try to do that? And it's amazing that their statement wasn't presented, that the jury didn't know that there was somebody other than Stan who saw Jeff that day hunting, you know, 27 miles away and could provide a timeline. I have no clues.
It is weird. And it does seem like that rule, Susan, was made for this situation, right? Somebody with a diminished capacity who like literally can't talk or didn't remember. I mean, what is it for if not that, right?
Well, it's typically used for refreshing memory. So like a witness who can testify, you say like, do you recall? It's like, no. You say, well, here's what you wrote then when you did remember. Does that help you?
Right.
But it also can be used when declarant's unavailable, which is when the person who wrote the statement ain't there.
Right.
So that's how the detectives could have gotten it in. And also, you have two detectives who think your guy's innocent. Like,
right.
Put that on the stand. Come on.
Right.
Well, that's the thing I can never understand. If you have two law enforcement officials who conducted an investigation who have cleared him, that should be your first line of defense. This is going to get us out of here. This is going to let him walk. And that's the confusing part, why that wasn't pursued.
Susan, we talked about Bonnie Huffman, sort of these anti-alibi witness. We also have Pat Burnworth. Can you just remind us who Pat Burnworth is?
Pat Burnworth is Bonnie's mother. She was also there and also testified. And her, we'll get more into that later, but what's she's passed away, so we couldn't talk to her. But what's strange is they do try and use her to also break Titus's alibi by having her say, oh, yeah, Titus came over that night. And she does at one point in her testimony imply that he came over earlier to match her daughter's timeline. But when she's confronted with her prior statement, where she said it was 8 to 9, like she quickly folds, like she immediately like deflates. She's like, oh, I may have said that. Yeah, I guess that's probably right. And whereas under direct, she'd been kind of hinting that Titus was there around sunset. She does, when confronted with those statements, you know, she gives up. Like she doesn't try and push it. And yet when Bonnie gets up there, they never try and bring up her prior statements or her mom's prior statements. And they just let it go as if like they don't even challenge it, really.
Did Titus's attorneys want him to get convicted?
I mean, you know,
I know it doesn't sound like this is, you know, you hear sometimes about, you know, not doing things, misconduct or whatever. This is just like neglect. I mean, it's just like you have these potentially awesome witnesses, these two cops. You have a question that you asked one family member, but not the other when they're talking about the same incident. I don't know. I just find myself wondering if his attorneys wanted him to get convicted. Can you just tell me how Bonnie's statements evolved exactly in the case? Because you said that she initially said one thing and then at trial said another.
Well, Jacinda and Kevin probably can address better the first statement from Mercy Mill, which is an interesting issue on its own.
So the story is that, from Jeff's point of view, the story is that they get home that night. They talk to the cops. It's about 7 o'clock when they get home. They find out what's happening. They take the deer to Jeff's barn where Stan starts to dress it. And Jeff decides to go down to tell his neighbors what's going on. So he goes down there to tell them what's happening up at his property. When Bruce interviews Mrs. Burnworth, she says it was around 8 or 9 o'clock because she was getting dinner ready and they eat late. And Bruce remembers that. He remembers it very distinctly because he says he was in the service and he was stationed in Europe. And he said to her, oh, like the Europeans. And she said, yeah, we eat late, 8 or 9 o'clock. And that was the original statement that Jeff did go down there. And Jeff admits he went down there to tell them what was happening. And that's what changes, you know, 10, 11, 12 years later when the cold case team starts to investigate. That time change. And her daughter was there, too. So the three of them were talking. That changes from 8 to 9 to 6:15, which would not fit the timeline at all. And as Susan said, by the time the trial comes, it changes again to 5:15.
Really interesting. I have a question. How did Bonnie and Pat end up as witnesses in this case when their change story doesn't fit the theory of the prosecution? Can someone of you answer that for me?
I mean, they say it fits and no one really calls him on it. So I guess
because
it
fits. His lawyer wants him to get convicted.
Okay. Well, I will say there possibly was someone on the defense team who did want or have a motive to want Jeff get convicted, but we'll cover that later.
Oh, boy. Okay.
515 would fit.
But he can't get back. But he can't get back in time. So the big issue here is that Jeff has to be back before the Shepherds or Stan knows he's gone. And Stan is going to be coming in as soon as it's too dark to hunt, which is like 5:45 p.m. I guess theoretically, maybe Stan hunted illegally a bit longer and pushed it, but most likely, and Jeff certainly can't believe that, they can't trust that Stan will do that. So from Jeff's point of view, he has to be back by 5:40.
Right.
Once you start putting this 5:15 timeline in, it just can't be done. It's a 40-minute drive. And even if he speeds the whole way, it's, 35 minutes?
Yeah.
So if Bonnie's out of the woods at 5:15, there's no universe in which he's back before dark.
Yeah. Can you explain to me why you seemed so confident that Jeff Titus wouldn't have even driven in that direction if he were heading back toward the Shepherd Farm?
Well, his witnesses, the people who know him, are confident.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Even Stan, you know, he says if you were leaving Jeff's driveway, you would have turned left, not right. Hmm. Going right, you would pass, you know, Bonnie, and going left, you don't. So what he would typically do if he was heading out to the Crandalls or to the Shepherds was to go left out of his driveway.
It really, like, I always call this the whoever smelt it, dealt it, a theory of prosecutions. There's this idea that, like, every criminal, like, does something super obvious to make themselves seem less suspicious, like saying to someone, hey, did you see that body over there? Like, that's essentially what they're doing here, right?
Well, I think that the cold case guys are saying that he had to pull into her driveway because she saw him. Right?
But why?
She saw him driving by, and at that point, he had to pull in because
but why?
right. But why? That's a good question. But that's their theory as to why he talked to her. He wasn't trying to point anything out. The facts as they add up, like, you know, could he get back if he 5:15 and then he went inside for 15, 20 minutes? Like, to me, it's still debatable whether he could get back. But everything has to go perfect. He has to hit every light. He has to get lucky that Stan's running a little late.
Well, he can't get there before dark, though. There's no way, because 5:15 is when she leaves. She's got to walk the whole, like, half a mile back to her parents' house. So, like, at the very, like, she's sprinting. It's only, like, 5 minutes. So it's 5:20 before Titus gets in the door. Assuming Titus is even there for 10 minutes, not the half hour Bonnie says, that's 5:30. He now has 15 minutes to drive the 40 minutes to get there before dark. So I don't think Bonnie can, there's no universe that Bonnie can be fit in there.
Yeah, it's, you have to sort of be willing to ignore some of the laws of physics, I guess.
At the time-space continuum.
Yeah. Although one thing, Susan, is that from what I remember, Stan can't remember whether when he met Jeff that whether or not Jeff had the deer in the truck already.
He doesn't remember it at all.
That was going to be my question, yeah.
So, you know, that gives you a little more wiggle room if Jeff shows up and the deer's already there and it's getting dark. Like,
no, it's already dark. The point is, though, if he's at Bonnie's after 5:15, like, there, he literally cannot get back to the Shepherd's Farm in any kind of daylight.
To me, the thing that always stands out is, even if you get into the debate about could he have made it, could he have not, is the fact that she's changed her story so many times.
Yeah, that's it.
Becomes problematic. To me, it's either she doesn't actually remember, and then you have to really discount what she's saying, or why is she changing her story?
Right.
So the fact that she's changed it so much, I mean, Roy Ballard says it in our show, it's basically, you're talking about sort of, I think he says, a 2.5 hour change in the timeline from when she first gave her statement. Like, that's a huge difference in a decade. That's that's a substantial period of time. It's not that she changed it a half hour, even an hour. 2.5 hours.
Right.
And so why does she not remember, or is there a reason that she's changing it? And that's what keeps standing out in my mind, that I find so problematic with it.
Yeah. And I think it's Bruce during our interview with him who says it's almost like she changed it to fit a scenario.
Yeah. I mean, some people just get either, they either get pressured, or they just want to be helpful, or they just get psyched to be part of the narrative, right? So it's not, I don't think it's particularly hard to get a witness who you think might be malleable if you say, you know, hey, are you sure it couldn't have been this time? Because it had to have been this time, X, Y, Z, for our theory of the case. It's not hard to get someone there, right, Susan? You've seen that over and over.
It's incredibly easy. It's incredibly easy.
And the other question that becomes is, if you don't really remember, when somebody starts presenting you with something that are facts or what they feel are facts, that also shapes what your memory is.
Right, right.
Particularly a decade later. I mean, you know, if you talk to people about memories they have from a decade ago, I don't think most of them are going to be incredibly accurate. Even the most important moments of our lives are vastly different than what actually happened.
Right.
So the concept that she's going to get this right is, I think whatever facts she's being provided with during the discussion will impact her memory, whether it's conscious or not.
Correct. Yep. All right, we have a couple listener questions. Brooke, who I think we all know a little bit, wants to know if there was any sign of deer down and then stolen from the murder scene. Brooke says you'd think there would be blood or drag marks from the supposed stolen deer. Was this theory actually presented at trial? Jacinda, do you know the answer to that question?
As far as we know, there were no signs of a deer being shot.
Right.
I don't know that anyone looked for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No one would have known to look for it.
Hmm. But what Jeff has this thing where he like wants, he's like, if only they talked to Stan, then they could have CSI'd the deer that he shot. And he's like, I could have showed them where I shot it and they could have gotten my casing and matched it to my gun and they could have gotten the deer's blood and matched it to the deer like tag that I had from it, from the blood there, and like confirm the DNA of this deer he shot. I'm like, I don't think they're going to do that. Definitely not in 1990.
Yeah, though, back when DNA tests took like 6 months to get back, you're going to like do one on a deer, right?
Yeah.
We also got a question from Jason. He wants to know if Driscoll maybe heard of the gunshot that would prove that Titus shot the deer at the Shepherd farm. Susan, do you know the answer to that question?
He has no memory of that. Hmm. Whether he heard it or not, we'll never know because he just does not remember. And
right.
I think that's like a very fair thing for him not to remember. I know that at one point you hear Ballard say like, Driscoll should have remembered that. And yeah, would it have been helpful? Yeah. But like, that's something that legitimately, why would you recall if you don't find out for hours after? Like Driscoll doesn't know for a long time after this that Titus is even a suspect. Like
right.
For him, there's no reason to remember that shot. And you hear shots all the time when you're hunting. So that memory is just not there.
Yeah, it's totally, that's contextual. I was thinking about that too. It's like, if you are hunting, it's contextual to hear gunshots. So hearing a gunshot would not be unusual in any way. Like, why would it be memorable, right?
Mm-hmm. Huh. For the people there at the Fulton Game area who find out not long after there was a murder, they do recall it. Like, there's still enough of that recall there where they can be like, oh, those are those two shots I heard.
Yeah, because as a hunter, you do listen for shots because you're listening because maybe there's a miss or the deer's been injured and it's coming your way and you'll fire off the second shot so that you are aware of other shots. So, you know, theoretically, Stan would have heard and been aware of the shot and noted it because it was just him and Jeff hunting there that day.
Hmm. But to be clear, when would he first have been asked? If he remembered it, was it a few days later by ballot or was it 10 years later?
He
wouldn't have remembered 10 years later.
Yeah.
And because of Stan being, and Stan being Stan, he wouldn't say, he would not ever say he heard it if he didn't remember hearing it.
Right.
He just wouldn't.
And even if he heard it, he would say, there's no way for me to know for sure it was actually coming from Jeff.
Yeah.
Because he would say.
Yeah, let's be real. If he had heard it, it wouldn't matter anyway.
Exactly.
He would have said that.
James Comey, right?
Yep.
Jeff points out also that Stan was a little bit hard of hearing and that he didn't always hear the shots when they were out hunting together.
Right. Right. Now, Susan, before we just wrap up the conversation about this case and for this episode, you did tell me something about Stan that I found very interesting when I was sort of
texting you
about how I found his personality to be. You said that you saw a very human side of him, right?
Yeah. And his wife. I mean, I got to say, like, those two are proof that anyone can find love. those two were made for another, like, in a vat somewhere. They were designed. She's a lovely woman. She's a professional in her field. I mean, I think probably arguably more successful than Stan was, in fact. But they were, like, totally devoted to one another and totally thought that the other was, like, the best person in the universe. and seem very much in love, like even after 43 years of marriage.
Wow.
And I mean, she was very aware of a lot of Stan's attributes, but of course she saw them as like good things, as like, you know, signs of how rational, intelligent he was.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that the two of them, I mean, they've obviously had a very human connection, and he even acknowledged at one point, he's like, I would never do things for emotion, which is a lie, but he's like, except for my wife, I do it for her, for sure.
He spent a lot of the day we spent with him talking about his wife. Like, yeah. He was clearly in love with her.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it must be comforting to be married to someone who you know is incapable of lying or exaggerating in any way. Well, I do want to move on and ask you, Jacinda and Kevin, about the Killer in Question episode 4. We didn't get a chance to talk about it. That episode, The Bingo Queen. Jacinda, can you provide a summary of that case?
Sure. You know, I was laughing because Susan sent me a text. We describe it as a family drama. And Susan texted me saying, when you said family drama, I didn't know you were talking about The Sopranos. But Kevin, you always described it as like, what's that movie, Knives Out? It's the story of a family who's the matriarch of the family, the grandmother, and the mother of 7 children or more is found murdered in her apartment, and it tears the family apart. They can't find out who did it, and they start pointing fingers, and they accuse Olga's granddaughter, and they start blaming her, and it really rips what was a very close family apart.
Is that granddaughter Angie? Is that who we're talking about?
Yes. Yep.
So what was the evidence against her? Why did people think she did it?
There was no real evidence against her. She was the one who found her grandmother dead. She was running late for the first day of a new job. But she decided to, it was actually an old new job. Like, she had the job and left, but they had agreed to have her come back. And she was running late, but she had called her grandmother. Her grandmother didn't answer the phone, and she decided to go check on her and bring her some breakfast. And when she walked into the apartment, she found her there dead.
Hmm.
And people thought that was suspicious. Like, why would you stop when you're running late for your first day at a new job?
Hmm. Kevin, what are your thoughts?
Well, one of the things that really stands out to me about this story is it points out some of the things that can be problematic with some police procedure, right? So Angie takes this lie detector test. She takes 2, but I think it's the second one, is deemed inconclusive, or it's deemed that she may be showing deception.
But
I think in both lie detector tests, the police officer tells her that she's failed the test in the sort of interrogation afterwards. And, you know, that's terrifying. So she doesn't know, you know, that he's making that up the first go around, that it was inconclusive. The first test was inconclusive. The second test said show deception. But she doesn't know that he's making that up. So she's now responding to questions based on this assumption that it showed some kind of problem for her.
Yeah.
And that I think is right there the heart of some of what the issue with this particular story is, because her family now thinks that she's a suspect, or at least her uncle does, because the police officer is explaining what happened to them, and they don't interpret it as a normal tool that they're using in investigations. And, you know, she becomes under the microscope for 15 years because of that situation. I also think that the story really points out, like, we call it a family drama, because what happens when you can't have answers to someone that you love dying? Like, does desperation sort of overtake logic?
Right.
And you start looking for whatever explanation. And I don't think I still know exactly what happened that night. You know, I know that there are people who are, there's someone in jail, and I think he's obviously involved, and there's a suggestion that maybe someone else was there. There's no clear evidence of that. And everybody's been cleared, but yet there are still hard feelings because you can't let some stuff go, and logic doesn't apply. And I think that's the interesting thing about this story, is what it tells us about sort of human nature. It's not like the other Killer in Questions we've done, where you're really looking at evidence.
Right.
I think this is looking more inside the human experience and the human soul and mind. And that's a very dangerous place sometimes.
Right.
But the only reason it's not like the other episodes is because they actually couldn't get a tiny shred more to ever charge Angie. Like, it wouldn't have taken it much to do. I mean, the real evidence against her, at least from the family's mind, is that in an interview, the officer, Ilaraza, is that right? Yeah, he asked her, like, why was your car seen at your grandma's apartment that night when she was killed? And Angie's response is, well, if my car was there, someone stole it and took it there. And the detective is like, whoa, this is some real suspicious stuff right here. This girl sounding kind of hella guilty right now. And the family thinks that that's, again, evidence that she's like, why is her car there if she's not there doing the murder? And it turns out her car was not seen there. Like, he was making it up to try and bluff his way through the interview. Right. And she responds the way you hear in so many wrongful conviction cases involving false confessions, where they accept the fact that is being presented to them, in this case, that your car is there, and they're asked to explain it. So their explanation is, well, my car was there, but I wasn't there, so my car was driven by someone else. It was stolen.
Right.
It's not how she answered the question right off the bat. She said, my car wasn't there, my car wasn't there, my car wasn't there. He keeps pressing her, why was your car there? So you're right. It's like she has to come up for a reason because he's not letting it drop. And the answer is someone must have stolen it. And that almost sounds like an admission.
The most amazing thing to me, and you know, Jacinda and I were there for Fred, who's the one in the family who really believes that Angie was involved. And during the interview, something didn't ring true. And we were talking about it. And I was like, you know, you should talk to the detective about, you know, if he made this car thing up. Or I don't even remember now. Sometimes I steal Jacinda's ideas as my own. She made them up with that. One of us did anyway. And sure enough, she talks to him and he's like, I said it to see what her response was. There was no proof that her car was there.
Right.
But yet the family didn't know that.
Right.
Until
our interview. Time.
Right. So that's troubling, right? Because it's a standard police sort of tool and tactic. But the family's interpreting the response one way, and the detective's not interpreting the response that way.
Right, right.
But it set off this sort of chain of events where the facts that they were both dealing with weren't the same, then, the detectives and the family.
Right. And it's not like the police ever follow up with people and say, hey, we were wrong about this, FYI. That's not a thing that happens.
Just follow up and say, this is the tactic we used, or something like that.
Exactly. So how can people watch this episode of Killer in Question?
They can watch this episode or any episode of Killer in Question on the IDGO app at any time. They can get them there.
Well, Kevin Fitzpatrick, not my husband, but always lovely to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us this week.
Thank you, Rebecca. Great to talk to you.
And Jacinda Davis, always a pleasure to talk to Susan Simpson's alter ego. Thank you so much for being on the addendum again. I really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
And Susan Simpson, what are we going to hear on the episode coming up on the Jeff Titus series?
We're going to hear about Jeff, the territorial landowner, at least according to prosecution.
Great. I can't wait. Susan Simpson, thank you so much.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum. Do you have questions for the next addendum? You can email them to undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or send them to us on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And where you can hashtag, use the hashtag UDAddendum. Audio production for the addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. The executive producer of Undisclosed is Methil Telhan. I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and if you want to hear more of my takes on true crime, check out my other podcast, Crime Writers On. You can follow this show on social media everywhere at Undisclosed Pod. Thanks so much for listening to this week's addendum. We'll catch you next week.